Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. It is time once again on this frigid, frigid evening here in Greater Cleveland for America's Most Haunted. With me, as usual, I used to say always, but we've missed a few, so I long to be correct at all times. The world famous haunted housewife, Teresa Argy. Hello, Teresa. Are you staying warm?
I am staying warm because I'm staying inside, and that is pretty much the only way to do it right now.
Staying warm. So have your kids had now 3 days in a row off of school?
This has been an extreme punishment for parents who have been stuck with their kids now because we were off Friday. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and they're off again tomorrow. So I don't know if they'll live till Wednesday. We'll see.
Tomorrow's Wednesday, dear, but that's okay.
Yes, they might not make it till tomorrow.
Okay. All righty. Well, hey, we are going to travel slightly to the, I don't know, is this the right or the left? I suppose it's the right of our really hardcore paranormal type show, but it's going to be amazing because, of course, part of what we cover in the social media and just our own interests just include mysteries, the mysteries of the world, great stories. That's what we're all about, not just about ghosts and monsters and whatnot. In the sixth season of Travel Channel's Mysteries at the Museum, airing Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, History Explorer, I love that title, Don Wildman leaves no artifact unturned as he scours America's archives, uncovering objects that bear witness to some of history's most astonishing secrets. What a great show it is. And, of course, Don is not only host of that show, but he's been involved with many other kind of historic, mystery, travel, all kinds of really great, interesting, educationally-oriented reality shows. And we are very pleased to welcome you, Don.
Thank you for having me. It's a great honor to join you. And I sound like a relentless man in that description. But I've been doing it for a while, this kind of show about history and mysteries and stuff, and it's always a thrill to do it. I really like the subject matter. So thanks for having me on to talk about it.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. I was looking into your background, and it looked like you had quite a bit of training as an actor. How did you sort of transition from that? Not that you're not doing it still, but how did you move from that area into kind of this meta cool guy, grizzled, handsome host of shows look thing?
Yeah, well, it's an organic process is what really happened, and more connected than it seems. I'll spare you the gory details of years and years of unemployment and all that goes along with the average acting career. But I went to acting school out of an interest in both acting and directing. And the directing was interesting for me because I liked the background of the plays. And the more I pursued acting, I did a lot of stuff in the early years of as a commercial actor. You know, I was doing a lot of commercials. I was the Sprint spokesman and Oreo cookie.
That's right.
You know,
I'm sorry.
I was like the Dynaminute guy.
I kept thinking, man, I have seen and heard that guy forever, and now it's coming back to me. Excuse me. Go ahead.
You can YouTube a bunch of commercials that I did, and I'm a much younger person doing it. But I used to love that life. I lived in New York, where I'm speaking to you from now. And I had that enviable life that you know, sometimes I wish I was doing still now, because I basically had a bike and an apartment, and I just rode the streets of New York going from audition to audition and booking commercials two or three times a month, doing voiceovers and stuff, and nobody knew who I was. I was just doing my own thing, making money and also doing plays, and it was everything I ever fantasized about as a kid, you know, having fun being an actor. But that runs its course after a while, and when I started asking myself what it was I was really interested in, the plays interested in me because of the stories behind the plays. When you're doing a Shakespeare play or anything, you research the story's history and the story of your character. And I found myself really fascinated by those backstories more than I was in how to do the play. You know, I frankly found the play a little less interesting for myself. And so that led me to full-time directing, which I, you know, then you're immersed in all of that stuff and educating the actors and so forth and all of those things. And it just was a really fascinating process of realizing that I liked research and I liked history. And one thing led to the next. Somewhere along the line, an agent said to me, you know, there's this whole reality TV thing happening, and if you'd like, we can put you up for some hosting roles. And I said, oh, sure, why not? And I do a lot of outdoor activity. I was always a camper and a canoeist and all that sort of thing. And so they got me a show on ESPN, and I was off and running, and it was a big travel show. And then I just fell in love with that, and I started going to South America and rafting rivers there and fishing all over the place and doing this kind of presentational thing about wildlife adventure. And I learned that I could take what I had done in commercials right into hosting, which was basically relating to a camera as if it's your friend, you know, and somebody who's with you. And that's what I do now. You know, I'm there with a cameraman, of course, but the camera is the audience, and my job is to make it kind of an intimate experience to go and adventure into these places and understand why you're there. So it's really a neat combination of the acting. You know, there's some of that energy going on, but it's also sort of a teaching experience and even directing. You know, it's this whole mixed bag that I was all the way along, and now it's come to focus on this particular kind of subject matter, which is its own story.
That's amazing. It really does make sense. It really is organic. And as I was saying to Don right before we went on the air, that he is so good at the hosting and at the presenting that there are times when you just forget he's there.
You know, when I was...
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Thank you, first of all. Yeah, the idea is that you should not be thinking about a guy hosting you, you know, that you should feel like you're there as much as possible. That's the ideal. And there aren't that many hosts on television. It's an interesting thing to think about. About 10 years ago, I remember an agent saying to me, the host thing's dead. There's no hosts anymore. They're going to get only experts and you know, people in the field, like doctors and decorators and that sort of thing. That's the world. And, in fact, he was right in many regards. But there was also this other thing where if you, you know, could step into the camera a little more, try to make that thing go away and include somebody in your space sort of effortlessly, there was going to be a market for that. And that's still the world. I mean, Travel Channel, more than any other network, cashes in on that, I would say. They use hosts more than most people do. And they're all really good at that kind of thing of just making somebody feel like they're along for the ride, which is a really neat technique, and it's important because television otherwise is just this sort of, you know, there's so much television. So if you don't have somebody to relate to, you know, you're not going to really absorb what's going on. It just becomes that channel surfing. I'm the worst channel surfer in the world. I just sit down and I'm like, it just keeps on going. So I depend on somebody, you know, somebody I relate to. So I hope I do that for some people out there. That's the whole goal.
Oh, well, you absolutely do. You do it extremely well. And so much so that I was realizing just now when you were talking, I have kind of always assumed that you were actually involved with putting the stories together. Do you get involved with the writing, with the research?
I do. I mean, what has happened, I'm really kind of giving you the basis of all of this transition in my life. What happens when you're on a show that goes for multi-seasons is an organic, a wonderful organic thing. You start to get, you team up with these people that become friends of yours and coworkers in a way that anything's like that, any project that's successful. So the beauty of being a guy on TV now is that there's an enormous access to me, and I'm very available on Facebook and Twitter and all the social media things. So I get a lot of feedback from the audience and a lot of involvement from them. Plus, I'm really into this stuff. I do a show called Mysteries at the Museum. Okay, that's on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock. And it's a show that surveys 6 different museums in America each show. And I'm telling you, we've done hundreds of stories now. So there's so many museums in America. There's like 17,500 official museums in the United States.
Wow.
And that's true. That's like the American Alliance of Museums sort of puts these facts out there, which have in them a billion artifacts, you know, roughly speaking. It's just an enormous treasure trove of collection that has been done over the last couple of centuries. So this show delves into that world. I have always been a museum crazy person. Like, that's the reason I go places, is to go to see museums. And that's what many, many people do that. I mean, that's the way people travel, the way people live in their hometowns even, scheduling themselves around exhibitions and so forth. But it's such an interesting world because it really just, we kind of take it for granted. It's sort of this edifice of museums. They're everywhere, and we take them for granted. This show was such a bright idea because it kind of pulled back the veil of that and said, wait a minute, there's this whole world in there, and there's many artifacts that aren't ever seen, you know, these tons and tons of crates in the archives and so forth. So we go to these museums, and I'm part of this process of kind of opening up the conversation with these folks and saying, what do you want to show? What would be a great artifact in here? Are there any great stories that are the tips of icebergs of mysteries, be they murder or crime or paranormal or anything? We get into it if it's a good story.
Amazing. I envy that job and your role, and it makes perfect sense that you have sort of become part of this process. Like you say, you are the public face of the show. You're obviously in touch, the show and you, with the museums kind of as an entity. And yeah, I mean, with a billion artifacts, that's a lot of stories. You know,
the other day go ahead.
No, go.
The other day I was, I have like a lot of, the way I keep track of these travels that I do, and I do 3 shows for travel now. I do Mysteries at the Museum on Thursday nights. That segues into Monumental Mysteries, which was kind of a spin-off of Mysteries at the Museum, and that's the story of Monuments of America. Similar kind of format and intent, which is to say, you know, you might have a bridge that's named out, say the Golden Gate Bridge, or that Confederate soldier statue in the city park down south. All of these monuments represent something, represent a story. So that show does that, the stories of monuments. Then there's Greatest Mysteries, which is the third of that series, and it's kind of become this franchise where we go around the world and go to iconic museums in other places. Like, I'm going to the Vatican in February, and then to Jerusalem and doing stories of the Bible. And we go to these places, these great institutions, and do stories abroad. Just did Buckingham Palace, and I mean, it's amazing. And so I'm losing my track of thought. What was I saying?
Back to the enormous number of museums and the enormous number of artifacts all those stories and your integral role in bringing that to the public.
That show, I was very much in the conversation of, you know, come on, we got to go out there and beyond America and see what's going on in other places. I mean, it's just endless. I think, knock on wood, this could go on for a very long time because people find the stories. I know what I was saying. I was getting ready for an appearance, and I was going through these archives of my own. And the way I keep track of all these travels, because I'm on the road constantly, is I got to grab some little object. It might be a piece of paper. It might be some souvenir. It might be something I find in a trash can, anything that I kind of identify with the day. And I just make a collection of these things over the course of a season of television. And it literally collects on a Chotsky shelf in my office. And at the end of a season, I'll take all that stuff, which would look like a lot of junk to somebody else, and I go through this very careful process of putting together pages of these little objects, and I kind of paste them into books and so forth, and these crazy scrapbooks develop that I have of all these objects. And so the idea of collecting is very deep into my soul. My father passed it on to me. My grandfather was a major stamp collector and everything. And so I was the other day looking at one of these objects, and I was thinking, how funny is this? This is a banal little mundane object, but to me, it represents this enormous experience that I know, you know, that no one else knows. that's very much what happens in museums. You walk around and we know them as important categories of ceramics or whatever it might, bones, whatever you might be looking at. But there's a big story behind each one of those objects. And we take it out of the case, explore the story, find the people to interview, and tell these sort of miniature documentaries about these objects. It's a really cool idea.
It really, really is. And it's also very broadly based.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
yeah.
You have a very large potential audience because there's so many different angles. There's the history buffs. There's the sort of oral story kinds of buffs, the mystery buffs, and then the paranormal slash macabre side of it, which you guys cover really well. I mean, for me, it was no stretch at all to think, oh, God, you know, we'd love to have Don on here. That would be so fun. Speaking of whom, I have been blabbing a while now. Teresa, I know you're a big fan, and you had several things you wanted to get into, so it is your turn.
Yeah, I don't want to backtrack on the conversation, though. I was trying to pipe in there a while back. I just want to say, first of all, when you were talking in the beginning, Don, about what you do and the part about teaching, I know that your family has a background in teaching. And
yeah.
Some of the most influential people in my life and in many people's lives are good teachers.
It's
a wonderful trait to be able to be a teacher to people and museums. We're from Cleveland. We're based here in Cleveland, Ohio. We have some wonderful, great museums in our area, and a lot of Clevelanders aren't even aware of them, but people come from all over sometimes to visit our museums. They are fabulous treasure troves, but people kind of look at them as sort of maybe outdated or even kind of boring. I know for the younger people might think of a museum as something boring. But what I think your show does, the mysteries at the museum and the way you approach it with the viewers, makes it exciting. It makes you want to go to these museums, and I think that is crucial to keeping a lot of these places open, especially smaller ones.
Well, let me say one thing about teaching, and then I'll say something great about Cleveland. First of all, yes, my background is very much teaching, and my dad was a teacher. He was the most passionate educator I've ever met. He was in the New Jersey public school system. He believed in public education as a real important cause and was very active in the state college system after he was a principal of a high school. And so home for us was this sort of miniature classroom. And in my relationship with my dad, it was all about history. So he would teach me about history while we were gardening or anything like that. And it was all from that perspective of a teacher. And I grew up with this sort of very high ideal about what education meant in people's lives, and that the craft of teaching and the ability to teach was a selfless one, and that you did it out of generosity. And a good teacher stands up to facilitate the information to the teacher, to the student, not to show off, not to be an ego, not to dominate, but to facilitate. And that's an extremely rare quality to be able to do, especially in a classroom with a lot of personalities and a lot of kids who may or may not want to be there. Hopefully they want to. But it's an amazing skill. And our society, if I may get on a soapbox for a moment, does a terrible job of appreciating that and celebrating it. It's taken for granted. It's underpaid. And it's really a crime of our society, of American society, that we do not make that forefront in our lives. And I have just gotten involved in this and really decided that the last half of my life is going to be about pushing this cause in society of changing the tone and intent of the conversation from, oh, there's school systems and we get taxed and we got to pay for these things and to, oh, my goodness, we have schools. It's an amazing luxury. The teachers are the stars of that system. All right, so that's my teacher conversation, except the fact that I grew up, therefore I wanted to do it for a living, and that's what I do on TV pretty much, is I go out there and try to get myself out of the way as much as possible and celebrate this subject matter that I'm trying to facilitate. That's the gig.
Yeah, and absolutely, and I agree with you 100% about teaching. I think teaching, good teaching, is an art. It's not just a job. I think it's a passionate calling, and the ones who are really really well-versed and are good teachers, I don't even think, my daughter is very, very intelligent. She's a seventh grader, And she has teachers that I know she will remember for the rest of her life. They've impacted her so much, and they mm-hmm. make her want to learn, even subjects that maybe she thought, I'm not really interested in that, but they find a way to make that interesting. And I think that what you're doing is you're, like I said before, you're sort of teaching everybody by making these things interesting and discovering these stories, and it's all about good storytelling, too, and, sure. and history and tying it all together. Now, I'm a paranormal investigator. I'm a ghost hunter, whatever, and as goofy as some people might think that is, everything I do is based in history right. and based in learning about people and telling those stories. And with museums, I love museums. We have, by bringing the paranormal angle to light to the community, have saved museums from closing.
Oh, that's cool.
That, you know, I mean, they're little tiny local museums that maybe don't get a lot of people visiting or people don't even know about it, and you find out, hey, there might be a haunted artifact in there or a ghost roaming the building, and suddenly it becomes more interesting. Mm. And just keeping the doors open, you get to tell these stories for so many more years.
Sure, yeah.
So I think it's brilliant, and I love the museums, and you make them sound so interesting. And I want to hear your story about Cleveland.
Well, you said okay. So I was shooting in Cleveland around for Off Limits, which is a show that's about sort of no trespassing zones of America. And I did it for years with Travel, and it's where I first came to it with the station and with the channel. And we were doing like Plum Point, I can't remember the name, Plum Island, and Cedar Point, and different little places around Cleveland. And I had been there before but never really had a chance to explore the place. And what I do when I first go to any city I've never been to before is I go to the library, because I just like libraries, number one, but it's also like this Alamo of culture in every city. You know, like if you go to the library and it's a cool place, you know this is a cool city, because these people are sort of protecting the heart and soul of the culture in that building. You know, the theaters can come and go, the art museum's closed, the art galleries are gone if people aren't buying, but the library stands. So I always check it out. And Cleveland has a fantastic public library. It's like the New York Public Library here. And upstairs there's this little museum. You know, it's a really cool museum with all these glass cases of amazing Cleveland culture. There was this whole thing back in the 20s where there was this art club. I don't even know what the name of it was. I forget now. But there was a really cool and daring avant-garde world in Cleveland back in the 1920s. You know, it was very much the roaring 20s in Cleveland, as with other, you know, northeast cities and industrial cities, because that's where it was happening. That's where the money was. So I just got this glimpse into Cleveland through the library and the little gallery that was upstairs. Loved it.
Well, I've yet to see that. I've not seen that. My mother worked at that library for years and years and years before she was married, and it was always such a magical place for me to go to.
Yeah.
Main branch of the library downtown is beautiful, but
it's architecturally part of an amazing plan, isn't it? Downtown mm-hmm. Cleveland had a real solid civic plan, as I understood, from that library, and those buildings look a lot alike down there, right?
Yeah. And I would love to see it come back. I would love to see the culture more celebrated in Cleveland. It's kind of struggling, but hopefully we'll be bringing it back. Now, I'm not sure if I remember this, but did you on Off Limits? Did you go to the salt mines here in Cleveland? Was that one of the places that
we never did? No, that was not one of them.
That,
but I've heard
talk about an interesting place that people don't even realize exists.
Yeah,
right.
Well, there's salt everywhere
miles,
in the Midwest, isn't there?
The salt. It's just amazing. It's a
Do they give tours down there?
Not to the general public, but I'm sure you could get in.
Yeah. There's a big salt mine under Detroit, too. That's a similar kind of situation, probably the same salt deposit, you know. It's salt mines are really mysterious places, and I've been through a lot of them around the country and around the world. The most mysterious one was Romania. We were doing a story about a whole show in keeping with your show, more of the about Dracula and about Vlad the Impaler in Romania years and years ago. And we were looking for a way to modernize the story, and we called a bunch of spelunkers and to see if we could get underneath in somewhere, and they took us to a salt mine, actually, and talked about the ancient salt mines that were there from the Roman times and so forth. And I've never been in a more amazing environment than this place. You know, just the artistic sculptures that were naturally made just by dripping salt onto a ladder, you know, for 20 years, and things, everything was coated in salt. And if you held your flashlight against the wall, the light would go into the wall, and you'd illuminate the depth of the thing just because, you know, it traveled in the salt. Not to mention the fact you can lick the walls, which is just cool anyway.
Well, you could do that in a mercury mine, too, but it would be somewhat more dangerous.
Yeah. I have been through
that. Just, I mean, you think about these places that are right under our people's noses in their communities they might not know about, which I think is great that shows like Off Limits will take you to a place and you can see places like this that you might not know even exist in your own hometown. But I tell you, I get, my heart skips a beat and I have to hold my breath when I see you trying to crawl into these tiny little tunnels. There's one episode, it was just on the other night, I don't even know if it was a repeat, but you literally were squeezing yourself through a cave opening in a rock formation and you were blindfolded, taken to the site. I think it was in either in Germany or Romania or Russia or something. I'm claustrophobic, and I was like,
oh, really? Yeah. It's not pleasant that, for claustrophobe to watch this stuff. I understand that. It's somehow I don't have that chromosome or whatever that is that makes people feel that way, but I sure understand it, because in the aftermath of any of our shoots, I would look back and think, oh, my goodness, what were you thinking? There was one West Virginia, Tennessee. It was in Tennessee, and we were climbing into a coal mine to explore how coal mining was done on a very small scale. This tiny little impoverished village just made enough money, scraping the earth to get enough coal out of these very unproductive caves. And because it had been such a not big process and a not big business, it had been left in a very kind of raw state. And so we went in to tell the story, which is basically addressing what you're saying. Again, it's much more exciting to watch someone experience something they're explaining than to have someone present it as information. You know, that's sort of the difference in the hosting that I do. It's sort of that, I don't compare myself to him at all, but George Plimpton was, you know, the god of this kind of thing, the experiential journalist. And he, you know, became a Detroit Lions quarterback and wrote a book about it and so forth. That's the world.
Paper Lion.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sort of dipping my toe into that much greater world that he represented by doing these things that are dangerous or risky anyway. I heighten the experience for the viewer. Plus, it's a lot of fun for me. You know, I just like doing it. And remember, there's a cameraman with me, and these guys are my buddies. And so we're just having a good time, like little kids going in these places. They're doing the heavy lifting with cameras on their shoulders and so forth. But what it does is it compresses on television. It gets very small, and the lens probably does that somewhat optically or whatever, but it just makes it a very intense experience visually. So what I'm going to say to you, you're going to pay attention to, because you're saying, get out of there. and that helps facilitate the information. I started all of this on travel, in Weird Travels. That was my first gig. You know, I did.
Right. We had someone ask about that.
I had a
Twitter person ask about it.
I love that show, and it was really interesting. That was more of a presentational thing. I was like a ghost host. You know, I get films just doing the lead-ins and wraps and so forth and narrating the whole thing. But I'd hear about these places that they shot all the recrees at and recreations and stuff at the sites and so forth. And, you know, many, many ghost stories. It's amazing. I really admire the whole world of paranormal, and because it is that. It's a history investigation. There's no way around it. That's what you're doing. Maybe you'll run into the ghost, but along the way you're going to talk about it. You know, that's cool.
Well, of the two of us, we actually just finished writing a book, and that's what America's Most Haunted is. That's what the brand is. And mm-hmm. Teresa's absolutely the expert. She is the real-world investigator. She's been out there for years and years and years going on these investigations. I came at it more from kind of the media angle, and I've certainly, you know, learned an enormous amount along the way. But that's kind of exactly what the book is. It's looking at the history behind these haunted locations and trying to determine if the myths and the legends do have a basis in fact, and trying to sort the fact from from fantasy and then going from there. And of course, talking about what's going on there now, and we do have a travel element in case people want to go. We're giving them the information on, you know, where to stay and hours and just all that, where to get that kind of information. So, you know, other than the fact that we are focused specifically for this book on ghosts in these 10 locations, there's a lot of similarities to our approach in terms of it's the history that makes it important. It's the history that makes it real. It's the history that makes it human. And then beyond that, it's just, you know, what direction do you choose to go? What I was really interested in hearing from you, besides your background and how the show works and all the really fascinating things we've got to so far, is what have been some, for you, some of the more impactful, either paranormal or just, you know, macabre or just super weird of the stories on any of the shows, but, you know, obviously Mysteries at the Museum, the ones that really stick in your mind and how real on the paranormal side of it, are these stories, any of this, for you personally?
Well, we're a natural filter, I suppose, of the stories that end up on our show are going to be very substantiated, you know, are very substantial. We can't just go, they're going to be things that have been sort of corroborated and so forth. So we do have a lot of paranormal stuff, and whenever I've worked on it with these guys and narrated these things and so forth, they're all like, you take them really seriously. You know, it's the guys of the Annabelle the doll, you know, the occult museum out in Connecticut, and the Conjuring folks and all that stuff, and the exorcisms, and these stories are really amazing. And I mean, even if you were a complete skeptic, it's still an amazing story because these things happened. Whether the origin was really what you're, you know, suspecting or not, it doesn't matter because the people had these experiences and the history is there. So that's been my experience with all of the stories that we've reported. And I've been left with I tend to sort of backtrack in life back to knowing less than I thought I knew all the time. And as much as I get more and more educated, I still don't have the big answers to anything. And that seems to leave the door open for pretty much anything. And that's a good thing. You know, I'm never going to get to be a person who just says, you know, I don't believe in any of that stuff. Because the day I do that, I'm just not open to the experiences that I very well might have. My greatest aspiration is to see a ghost and an alien. And I haven't seen either of them. But I would love to, because the thing about seeing a ghost, if you saw a ghost, the whole thing opens up then, because if there's an afterlife, then there's a God, and there's all kinds of things. And to me, ghosts are most fascinating because of the theology they represent. It's just, it blows one's mind. So if you're really believing, if you're a believer, then you believe in all of that stuff.
God, you sound like me. It is so funny. I always end up coming around, you know, when I'm discussing and blabbing about how I got into it and why is this important to me and you know, what am I getting out of this? And I always come back to, it is exactly what you said. It's the profundity, the profound questions about life and the afterlife and science and religion, that they're all bound together in this topic. And just like you said, if you really, really, really have a ghostly experience, then the implications are staggering.
Oh, exactly. Right there. I mean, pretty much any conversation you have about ghosts, and they're always these, ooh, the hair was up on my neck, and it's all kind of hoogly-googly stuff, but really what it immediately brings up to mind is, oh, my Lord, there's another level. There's a whole other thing here. And I believe the people that tell me about these things. I don't have any reason not to. Well, I wasn't with them. You know, I trust them. I don't just do this with anybody. But, I mean, if it's somebody I know and a good friend of mine, my brother-in-law, for example, who I admire more than anybody, tells me about the fact that he was sitting on a beach in Scotland and a flying saucer went over him in the morning. I've known this man for 40 years. Every 10 years I say, okay, seriously, that story you told me when we were 20, did it really happen? And he's like, yes. You know, this is a man who's nearly 60 now. Yes, it really happened. Well, as soon as if that's the case, then it's all got to be true. If I'm going to believe my brother-in-law, which I do, then therefore I believe. So,
I agree. I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm following our Twitter feed and our interactions. Teresa runs the chat room. I'm sure there's some things going on there. But a really great question from Mary Ellen Hamm, who is listening right now, and she said, "Would you ever?" Excellent. Would you ever consider joining the Ghost Adventures crew on an investigation since you're all Travel Channel?
We have talked about it. I'm so insanely busy. I literally had a conversation with Zach Bagans last week. He was shooting in Los Angeles, and they were going to shoot at a place that I had already covered for Off Limits. And he said, hey, first of all, he's just calling me up to say hi because we'd never actually talked. And it was really nice. He's a great guy. Anybody who thinks Zach Bagans terrific, they're right. He's a very nice and intelligent man. And he was shooting at a place, they were shooting a lockdown at a fort in Los Angeles that I had covered years ago on Off Limits. So he was really asking about the dimensions of the place and getting ready to sort of produce the piece in there. But in the course of the conversation, he said, you should come down and do this with us. I was like, okay, I'd like to, but I know that they get very intense on that show.
Oh, yeah.
I've only seen it a couple of times, but I just don't know how I would behave under those circumstances. I'm really not sure, and so I didn't want to. I couldn't actually. I mean, to do that, I'd have to. It's like you're mixing brands there, so that takes an okay from the folks above and all that sort of thing, which they may very well have said yes to. There's no written.
I think they enjoy that kind of thing. Well, sci-fi, of course, does it all the time. They're always cross-promoting their, you know, various shows.
That's true,
Travel, probably less so.
Another great guy
think.
From sci-fi who I know pretty well is Josh Gates, and he's just a terrific guy as well.
We were talking about you and your background and your approach, I was kept thinking about Josh Gates. You have a lot of similarities.
Have you interviewed him?
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
We have.
Oh, yeah, several times,
Very nice.
Well,
guy.
Not several, probably 3, 4, 5 times.
Yeah.
Very interesting, very educated.
I did a show
educated.
With Zach Bagans a couple years ago. I was on that Paranormal Challenge, so I did get to meet Zach in person, and he's very intense. He's not much different than what you see on TV. He's very intense, and you know, you're talking about cross-promoting, and it would have been cool for you to have an experience and go to one of these haunted places with them. But honestly, I'm glad that the Travel Channel doesn't do what Sci-Fi does, because I think that cross-promoting does not seem organic. It just kind of – it seems really forced, and it seems like it's just a marketing ploy. Whereas, like you said, you know, they contacted you or you contacted them about this place that you had been to for information – and that just seems to make more sense. That would have been kind of cool, but...
Well, specifically, you know, I would have been in this role of being more of a guide, and I think that would have kind of diminished their experience, because I had already reported on this place and had my own experience and done a TV show about it and the whole thing, and it just would have made me maybe a little too much of an insider of the place, and therefore I wouldn't have bought me on that show, you know, having that experience, because I'd already been on this other show doing it, so... Yeah, the freshness wouldn't have been there, I think.
Now that we've broken the barrier and asked a question off of Twitter, they're starting to pour in.
Ask me more.
Okay, well, here's one from Starbuck, no A in there, STRBuck. Mm-hmm. Asked Don if they ever considered coordinating an educational component through actual schools with Mysteries at the Museum.
Very good question. How do I even start that? Well, you know, you're dealing with the television world, and we make television. So anything outside of that is more of a corporate issue. and could happen down the road, but it's probably driven, the effort to do so is driven by the talent themselves. So what I was referring to very briefly in the last half of my life, I said, is going to be about education. That's really what I'm doing. I really enjoy the fact that kids pay attention to my shows. When I was a kid, I would watch Jacques Cousteau and those kinds of things, and I dreamed of diving with Jacques Cousteau, but he was so far away, so impossible, France in that case, but television was inaccessible. It was another world, you know, and that had its own purpose in that you were sort of left to your own devices to take from it what you would. But I like it better now, where people can actually feel like these guys aren't these sort of gods on television anymore. They're just people like us, and we can talk to them and so forth. And best of all is when a 14-year-old writes me and says, I'm really curious about this fort in my town, what happened? And I can not only sort of give him some facts and figures, but I can also encourage him to find out on his own. And that's so cool. Of course, with the Internet and everything, all of that's so much easier these days. And that's my most immediate ability to facilitate that kind of educational thing. But, yes, I want to get more organized and get use television in the schools to encourage kids to enjoy history and geography most of all. Geography, I think, is so it's been pulled off the table for science and math, probably for every good reason in the world, but a lot of kids just don't know where things are anymore, and that used to be something that was a bigger priority.
You're absolutely right, and that process has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
The natural solution
to that, I think, is for people who care to step up, and I care, so it's my job to step up, and so I'm trying to use the time that I have to do some writing and to do some creative thinking about how to do this. It starts local. Everything starts local. I can be highfalutin about all these theories, but unless I, you know, step out of my office and go walk down the street to a school and say, hey, I'm a guy on TV, let me help you get your kids excited about stuff, then I haven't done anything. So the onus is on us to make changes, and that's how I have to do it.
Well, back to the reality on the ground right now. If you never did anything more than you're doing now, you are a functional educator. You are serving that role. My kids, I have two younger kids, 10 and 14, and they love your shows. I mean, we've watched all of them, but, you know, in particular, kind of right now, we're focused on Mysteries at the Museum, but we've watched all of them, and they always, you know, recognize you. Oh, there's that guy from, you know, Mysteries at the Museum. But you really do have an air of easy authority. It's not a bossy authority, but you really are believable and easy to listen to. And obviously that applies all the way down to kids because, you know, I told you I was just watching the latest episode before we went on, And you know, my 10-year-old son was sitting there watching the whole thing with me and asking questions, and he was transfixed. You know,
you're gonna make me cry. I love this.
The balloons, the guy, he was from San Pedro. I'm from San Pedro. I had never heard that story
before.
Oh,
that's interesting.
Like, my God, where was I?
That's,
you know,
I was off in
another world in 1982 because I was there. I wasn't in San Pedro. I was in Hermosa Beach in 82, and I don't know how I missed it. I was never seeing the news at that point. I was DJing for a living. I was out all the time. Drank a lot, you know, blah, 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 blah. But what an amazing, who would believe that?
The guy
in a freaking lawn chair and balloons goes up 16,000 feet and nearly sucked in by an airliner, by LAX. That is the most amazing story. Before I forget, just because my brain jumps all around, one of the paranormal-related stories that you have told that really stuck with me was kind of the birth of spiritualism and the sisters. Do you recall that? Does that one stand out in your mind?
This is an upstate New York story.
Right.
I believe, or Brooklyn, I don't know, but it's so much happened around the New York area in those days. Remind me of some details.
Well, there were sisters who
the foxes.
Were
foxes.
Yeah, right. I knew Teresa would know. go ahead, Teresa.
Oh, I'm just saying it was the Fox sisters, and yeah, they were in upstate New York, and they were teenagers, and they basically the experience they had in their farmhouse. They were communicating with the spirit of a traveling salesman who supposedly was murdered and buried in.
And they dug up the basement floor, and they found the chest, right? They found a chest there.
Later, even after both girls, they recanted their stories, and they said that they had faked it. And then they recanted their recant years later, and they did. And after they did that, they did end up finding the bones in their old farmhouse. So it's a crazy story, but that's the spiritualist movement is, the whole thing is fascinating to me. And we don't realize, I don't think we realize today how extremely popular it actually was after the war in the United States.
And it was just in that cusp of people embracing science, you know, and the shift that happened in the 20th century. There were so many people that were involved in seances, and it really came out of England, didn't it? You know, it was really the big stories were out of England and London of the occult and all that sort of thing, and then it came over and had these certain figures in the United States. But there was also as strong a movement as there was for, there was one against, and Harry Houdini was very deeply involved in debunking things. You know, there was just an amazing conflict in society of people saying no and some people saying yes, and in some ways still continues today.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the more people know about science, the less they aren't able to embrace anything that science cannot fully explain. But
right.
A lot of things that we thought were superstitions 50 or 100 years ago are now proven facts. So that's the importance of history and learning from it and discovering from it and not just dismissing it outright. I think today, in today's society, in 2014, people are, in general, are arrogant, thinking that we know it all.
Right.
And they're unable to think that it can't possibly happen because we can't explain it now, so it can't possibly be true.
It really does go side by side with me with religious questions. It really does. And people are very, very serious about discussing religious questions and sometimes not so serious about talking about afterlife and spiritualism having to do with, you know, entities and so forth. But really they're the same thing, you know, and therefore deserve both, the same profound discussion in both camps because, you know, if you're going to say God exists and be serious about it and pray and raise your children according to those values, that's a pretty big leap, you know. So if you're willing to do that, then why not be able to leap in the other direction with the afterlife? It's pretty side by side for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I loved what you said a little bit ago, where you said, you know, the more you learn, the more information you gather, the more of these stories that you learn, the less you realize you know. I feel the exact same way. Some of the things when I was a young man that I felt absolutely certain about, you know, just rock solid, are wide open questions for me. And, you know, there's a humility, I think, that comes with being honest as you get a little bit older and you have been around and you've experienced life, you know, as an adult, I guess, for a while, you know, you can, in the one direction you can go, well, man, I know it all because I've been around. But I think if you're really honest, then you realize, well, because I've learned as much as I have come to realize how little I really do know and how many questions, big questions, are left unanswered. You know,
it's either a good question or a really dumb question, but do you really in your heart of hearts believe that there will come a time when we do know? Do you think that there will be a time when the sense of understanding this will ever happen, or will we always be ignorant?
Are you talking about of the paranormal?
Both. I mean, anything. I mean,
or of religion?
Is there going to be that
moment?
Well,
if the world ends and Jesus, you know, comes and taps me on the head, I will say, yep, that religious stuff, man, that was real. Big check mark on that. I mean, to be really serious, I don't know, you know, again, literally short of, you know, Armageddon and the rapture, I don't think we ever really will know. In my mind, there are intersections. They're not completely separate between science and religion, which I view as faith-based as opposed to proof-based. A lot of people think there's no connection at all. I don't think that. I'm not that extreme. But I do think, ultimately, religion is about faith and is not about proof. And I almost go up to that line. I know a lot of people will say, well, in a sense, if you had proof, that would actually diminish faith and the importance of faith. So in a sense would undermine it all. I don't know if I go that far. I'd love to have, you know, some proof. That would be great. That would be nice as far as I'm concerned. But I think ultimately religious proof or objective information probably has to come from within. And I think that happens. I think people feel that they have had experiences that are unshakable, that for them personally are unquestionable in terms of an actual real connection with the supernatural. And I think that applies absolutely similarly to the paranormal world. And I agree with you, Don, that it's hard, it's very hard to really separate the paranormal from the, you know, religious side of things. Although it's interesting, although I find it kind of strange to work it around in my mind, but, you know, there's a fair number of the ones we've interviewed anyway, or that I've interviewed, ghost hunters, paranormal investigators, et cetera, et cetera, more do have religious belief than don't, at least of the ones I've talked to. But there are quite a few who are, you know, really staunch atheists who believe very strong in the paranormal. For them, it's just kind of another realm, another branch of science that we just haven't figured out yet. And I'm sure there's truth to that, too. You know, the more we're getting into all this, the quantum, all this recent, fairly recent stuff with the quantum entanglement and, you know, development of quantum theory, and they're gradually figuring out how to get that quantum theory and the quantum entanglement from the micro world closer, you know, to our actual scale. And the closer the weirdness, the bizarre weirdness of the quantum world gets to our scale, or even, you know, the universe scale, then wow, then we really don't know anything, because that's all about uncertainty. I mean, that's exactly what that world's about. You know what? I just realized, because I haven't been paying attention, because, you know, I'm an idiot. We have actually had someone on hold, and I don't know if he or she is still there. Area code 716. They've been on the entire show, so they clearly would like to talk to you. Let us see if they are there, and see if we can. Okay, come on. Yeah, there we go. 716 area code. Are you there? No. I finally click on them and they're gone. I don't know how long they were really there. Maybe they weren't there. I hope. I'm hoping. Yeah. No. It's interesting that we've had as many questions as we've had via Twitter. Well, we've kind of asked you, I suppose. And you answered on your own about not having any personal experiences thus far with ghosts. What are your current thoughts or beliefs on the paranormal? Just what? How would you summarize your view
as of now? Yeah, you nailed it. And the sense of science taking us to a place of how little we know gives me credence of this stuff. I mean, there really is a lot of thinking in physics and so forth about these other realms and so forth that the soul could go to, you know, in some other way. And that's, you know, it's going to get so crazy 200-400 years from now, and when you consider how far we've come today. And I think that that science and physics and all of this will embrace these other realities, and we'll find that place that souls go to. That, because I mean, for me, it boils down to energy can neither be destroyed nor created. So, if our bodies die, there is energy in us which has to go somewhere. And if that's the case, well, that's a pretty good case for it went out into the ether in some form. And sometimes it goes beyond and doesn't need to come back, and sometimes it stays right here, depending on how it ended up going there. You know, if it was a shocking event of some sort of thing, that's a theory I know, you know, exists about people being sort of frozen in reality by some horrific trauma or whatever it might be. That makes sense to me. You know, I can't really get beyond the very sort of basic understanding of the stuff because I don't make it a big study, but it certainly makes sense to me that possibility exists. So that's really as far as I go with it. I'm sorry that I haven't had a personal paranormal experience, because I would be all over the place with this thing. I would be trumpeting it, you know. That's the only thing that confuses me about people who have had a lot of these things, because I haven't really heard about it in a really believable way that makes me go, oh, okay, now we're talking, you know. It's generally sold in a sort of entertainment format that invites skepticism. And
right.
I think it's a much more serious subject matter.
I
understand
that's
why.
An excellent point.
You know, it's scary, you know, fun world. And that has its purpose, and that's great. But it doesn't really address the very serious philosophical questions that are obviously brought up by the fact.
Well, once you do
excellent.
Have a paranormal experience as far as being a ghost or experiencing something like that, especially if you were a skeptic or maybe a non-believer to begin with, it really is a game changer. I mean, it changes your core beliefs. If you
mm-hmm.
never believed in the afterlife or had any sort of religious connotations, then you have an experience like this. It's kind of a metamorphosis that you go through almost instantaneously when you have it, which I think is remarkable.
Yeah.
But to get back to the question you asked a few minutes ago, Don, about if you believe that someday we will get to that point where things are proven. For me personally, I think that we're such a society of know-it-alls that even if Jesus or God or Muhammad or whoever it is you believe in came down to earth and went on national television and said, hey, here I am, people would still be like, nah, I'm not buying it. So I think that we're safe from living in a community that all the mysteries are gone. I think there will always be mysteries, and there will always be questions, and there will always be questions of faith
yeah.
and questions of the paranormal.
Yeah.
And I'm glad about that, because I don't want to live in a society or a world where all that mystery is taken away. Not knowing is half the fun of life.
Well, you know, I often think of the fact that, you know, some days I literally will sit down and sort of close my eyes in the middle of a busy day and remember that I'm on a planet in the middle of nothingness, you know, and it's a big, huge thing somehow magically spinning in a perfect arrangement. And it's incredible when you consider that that's working every day of our lives, and here we are. And so that puts me in the mindset of being able to embrace some other realities, because the reality that we all know and trust is pretty wild.
Yeah.
That is a great, great point. Hey, I'm trying area code 716 one more time. Are you there, area code 716?
Yeah.
I can't.
Are you there? Hello. Speak to us, area code 716. If I were them, hello, you there?
They were talking a second ago. I could hear them.
Yeah,
right?
I know. They were talking when we were. All right, well, we apologize.
Yeah,
we're trying. We brought you in twice. I'm sad that we were not able to ask.
Do we have any other phone calls lined up there?
Well, we didn't solicit, you know, and to be honest, we generally don't take calls unless we say we're going to. So we
all
have
right.
sort of we have accustomed people to us not answering the phone. But, I mean, we have literally gone our hour, and we could go on and on and on. So
well, let me,
no
let
issues
me take
with
one
filling
moment
the hour, Don.
Oh, well, thanks. Let me do one thing that I really should do as a television professional and remind the listeners that the show I'm on is called Mysteries at the Museum, and it's on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock. And I have some little preview of what's on this week. There's a Wild West story, a weapon that played a central role in a duplicitous plot orchestrated by a very unlikely outlaw. Then there's a Mariner story, and there's gemstones and everything else. And typical of our show, they're all really exciting short pieces that kind of feed you one to the next. You can't turn it off. There's my plug.
Fantastic, and well done. You must be on TV or something, man.
Yes, that's right.
You have a voice and a half. So, yes, Mysteries at the Museum, Thursdays at 9 Eastern and Pacific. And, well, let's give all of your – let us identify all the places in the world that people can find you. So your other TV shows and then your social media. Let's just whip it on them.
There you go. Go to Don Wildman Twitter handle. I think it's just Don Wildman. And you can follow me there. More and more I do that. It's actually very entertaining. I have been a very skeptical Twitter guy, but I've turned the corner on that whole thing. So I tweet a lot, and you can find me on Facebook pretty easily just by, Don Wildman in there. I'll get you two different pages that are pretty clearly me. I don't know if there's anybody else. I haven't looked at somebody faking me or not. There's a couple Don Wildmans in the world. One guy is a very famous gym owner. I mean, he started like Bally's Gyms or something like that. So you can run into him, and it won't be me. But anyway, there and that. I have a website which is right now being redone, and it's going to be a different kind of website in about a month. But you can still go somewhere called gotowildman.com, and it's more of a blog of places I've gone and sites I've seen. But that's all getting revamped over the next month or so. So there's a lot of cool stuff to look at. There's a whole world.
We have one more question. We have one more question. And you referred to it somewhat anyway earlier. Are you working on – you said you were writing. Are you working on a book? Several people have asked if you're writing a book or planning to write a book about your experiences.
Two things are part of 2014, and one is a book about the show, Mysteries at the Museum, and the mysteries in general, to go along with that. And I am thinking about writing something that's more of a memoir type of deal. I shudder to say the word memoir because it puts a statement on you deserve it, but I don't. But I have had an extraordinary haphazard life that has landed me in a place where, I have esteemed people like you asking me questions, which is just ironic to me. But I seem to have experiences that people are interested in, and I'm interested in telling them if they facilitate, again, the greater story. I mean, places that I've been have blown my mind, and if I can find the means to express that in such a way that people won't, throw the book down, then it's worth writing. And so specifically, places like Ethiopia and lesser known places in the world fascinate me that I've had really touchstone experiences in that opened up the world for me. I just like to make people understand that they're not impossible to go to those places and that life is really meant for exploring on a small scale or a grand scale, but always in the same mode that your life is worth expanding by understanding the puzzle that is the world and putting those pieces together one by one. It's like life should be one of those jigsaw puzzles that looks so overwhelming you'll never put it together. But if you really work at it for a long time, eventually there it is on the table. And you can just sit back and go, that's my version of reality.
Wow. That was pretty profound there. I like that.
Sorry about that.
Well, you are a fascinating guy, not just an excellent presenter, not just an excellent TV personality, but you are a deep thinker, and I would love to read a book that you wrote. And you've said some very interesting and thought-provoking things and things I'm going to ponder and mull over. And, boy, really, really enjoyed talking with you.
Really
charming, really interesting guy.
Are all your shows deeply philosophical like this? Every week you talk like this?
We kind of come around to it usually because of the topic. You know, it sort of invites, sure, we talk about fun stuff. We talk about nuts and bolts. But even when we're talking to people, we do sometimes go off in the horror film direction just because it's all, you know, one big... It's all under the canopy. It's all under the big tent, you know.
Yeah.
Even when we talk to actors or filmmakers who are you know, in theory strictly entertainers, we almost always come around to talking about, you know, what actual experiences have you had, or what are your thoughts on this, or what does this mean to you? And so, yeah, I mean, we do because I think for both of us, I don't want to really speak for Teresa, but I think for both of us, the real interest, or at least the importance of this field, broadly speaking again, are the philosophical and or religious, I suppose you could combine philosophical and religious and call it maybe metaphysical,
mm-hmm.
Implications of all this. Because
sure.
If there's any truth to any of it at all, we live in a very different world than is taught in schools or is viewed through the lens of science. There's a whole different, there's a whole other layer or layers that we don't have any direct way, anyway, of getting at. And so I think that's why people are so interested in the shows and in the topic. And you know, I mean, when you start looking at all the different places that the paranormal, again, kind of in the broadest sense, appears, I mean, it's everywhere.
It is.
You know, it's in fiction, it's in nonfiction, it's in comics, it's in TV, in both scripted and non-scripted.
Hello?
Out. Sorry, I think we lost him. Sometimes he talks himself right off the air.
Okay, sorry about that. I want to tell you, Teresa, are we still on the air?
Still
yeah,
on the air.
Something happened to my phone, I guess. Anyway, I'll shut up. Go ahead.
I wanted to, in closing, a larger topic that at some other time we can discuss, but I really never got around to, why are people scared of ghosts? Like, that seems like the weirdest thing that ever came to pass of spiritualism, the idea mm-hmm. of fear and violence being the go-to thing in the world of, in all of this world. Never made any sense to me. I understand it's created by entertainment and so forth, and or at least enhanced that way, but I never understand why I'm frightened of it, because I am, just like everybody else. It seems scary to me, and I don't get why. Like,
yeah, that's a topic for an entire hour or two show,
yeah.
But I think the short answer from my experience with dealing with people and collecting stories for all these years, they're just afraid of things they can't understand. And they're not sure what it is, what's happening, can't explain it, don't understand it. Being faced with their own mortality, I think the combination of those two just is a scary thought. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of comforting to think that when you're dead, you're not just dead and rotting in a hole, but that's just
exactly.
me.
All right. So, well, thanks, guys, for having me.
Another day.
Thank
really
you, and continued great luck with the show, all the shows, and really look forward to see what else you'll have going on by way of writing and appearances and all that kind of thing. Thanks so much,
touch.
Don. Really enjoyed it. Looking forward to talking to you again, hopefully soon.
I thank you, and I also thank all those people. I hope there were many of them who were listening. I really appreciate them doing that, so... Take care.
Yeah, there was a lot of people in the chat room, but the topic was getting a little off topic. So I didn't include some of those questions because they were a little different. But if you ever come back to Cleveland, there's some great places here in Cleveland, lots of mysterious, interesting, hidden stories that I'm sure you could bring to light for
All
the
right.
viewing audience. So maybe
All
we'll
right.
see you when you come to Cleveland, Don. Don't forget about us.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. Another great show next week. We're here every Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern. All right. Good night. Stay warm, everyone.